open this service with a prayer for Edmund Jaffers. And he will speak to, his subject is the vision of the 2300 days.
Our subject, the vision of the 2300 days, is taken from the book of Daniel, chapter 8, verses 13 and 14 in particular. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now perhaps no portion of the Bible could be considered of greater importance to the Lord's people in the harvest time than the prophecies contained in the book of Daniel. It is in the book of Daniel that we have much information concerning this time of the end period. The prophecies in the book of Daniel reveal to us things concerning this harvest time. You remember the prophet Daniel also presented to us the world history in miniature. He presented to us the five great universal empires. He gave us their origin and their final destiny. He spoke of God's kingdom being the fifth universal empire and picturing that by the stone that was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it grew until it filled the whole earth. Then it is Daniel also who reveals to us the important time period, the 1260 days, the 1290 days, the 1335 days, and the 2300 days that we're going to consider this evening. Now, how many besides the truth people are able to even give a reasonable explanation of these prophetic days? I think that these prophetic days have become faith builders to us in this harvest period, that we may be thoroughly convinced concerning the time in which we live that it is indeed the closing scenes of this harvest period. And so this evening we're going to examine this interesting prophecy, the vision of the 2300 days. Now this is a very significant prophecy, I believe, because it speaks and deals directly with the Lord's people. Now after the early church passed on, we find that gradually error began to creep in, and it began to defile the church. And this defilement continued to grow as one error naturally would lead to another error. And finally, all that you had left was just a mere front of godliness. And during this period of defilement, there were saints who recognized, more or less, that the church was being defiled. And they were concerned. And Daniel recorded their cry in verse 13 of chapter 8, when they shouted and cried, and they said, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgressions make it desolate? In other words, they're asking, Lord, how long will you permit this to exist? How long will the truth be trodden in this mire and in this error? How long will you allow this abomination to prosper? And God then gives the answer in advance, the terms of which the writer of the book couldn't possibly understand, because this answer could only be understood in a certain period in God's plan. designated as the time of the end. And the answer to the question was, how long? Until 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now the vision that Daniel observed is found in the 8th chapter, and you'll notice that in this particular chapter you also have the explanation. In the vision, Daniel saw a river, and before this river there stood a ram. Now this was an unusual ram because of the horns. Now, usually a ram has horns of equal length. But Daniel observed that one horn was much higher than the other. And he was wondering about this animal. And then he noticed that this animal began to push in every direction to such an extent that no beast or man was able to control it. And then as he was watching this ram pushing in all directions, he looked toward the east, the west. And there he saw another animal approaching, walking on air, as it were. And as it came closer, he noticed that it was a he-goat. And again, this was a rather strange animal. It was a goat, all right, but instead of having two horns, there he noticed one great big horn coming out from between his eyes. And I think that as he was watching this he-goat come, servant suddenly saw that this he-goat just turned upon this other animal that he was watching, the ram, and with all of his power attacked the ram. And in this vicious attack, the ram's two horns were broken off, and soon he succumbed to the battle, and then this he-goat began to stamp upon this ram, and of course was victor in this fight. Then Daniel observed that this one horn that this he-goat had between the eyes, that all of a sudden that just simply broke off, and in its stead he noticed that four more horns began to grow. And this was unusual. And then these four horns, as they grew up, he noticed out of one of these four, another little horn began to emerge. And this is the horn that horrified Daniel. Because this horn became great, it began to cast the people to the ground, and it mentions also stars to the ground, and it began to trample upon these. Then it also mentioned that the truth would be taken to the ground as worthless by this horn. And to make matters worse, all of this was done in a condition of prosperity. And then Daniel hears a conversation. Someone is asking the question, verse 13, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice? How long will the sanctuary be trodden underfoot? And then someone answered the question, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Daniel was confused. Then a voice breaks the silence. Daniel hears, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Gabriel approaches Daniel, and he finds Daniel there laying on the ground, his face toward the ground, trembling with fear. Daniel, says Gabriel, this vision that you've seen, that pertains to the time of the end. But Daniel listened to its explanation. Verse 17. That ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. This ram that you've seen, Daniel, represents this second universal empire, Media and Persia. The he-goat you've seen represents the third universal empire, Greece. Now here's something interesting to note.
in the image of Nebuchadnezzar. The arms and breasts of that image also are the things represented by the bear with the vision that Daniel had, and the ram also represented that power. So all three of these symbolic beings refer to this second empire. Likewise, Greece, the belly and thighs of the image, and the lepers in the vision that Daniel had represent Greece as well as this ego.
These are symbolic terms, and they have their meaning. Then this big horn, Gabriel continues, says that this big horn represents the first king of Greece. And then the four horns that you saw, Daniel, represent four kingdoms. Then that little horn that you were so concerned about, Daniel, that little horn represents a king, a fierce continent, powerful, mighty, and he's going to destroy the holy people of God. And in doing this, he's going to prosper. Then, Daniel, this horn, this power is going to stand up against the prince of princes. Then Gabriel concluded his explanation. He said, Daniel, this vision is true, but shut the vision, for it shall be for many days. Well, after this experience that Daniel had, he literally fainted, and he became sick. And he was sick for a few days, the scriptures tell us. And after recuperating, naturally he would be troubled. He didn't understand just what this meant. This was a strange vision. Daniel, you see, was especially interested in his people, the nation of Israel. And he was looking forward to the time when God's promises toward Israel would be fulfilled. He was waiting for that. And what he heard in this vision couldn't have possibly occurred in 2300 literal days, especially when Gabriel said that this vision, just close it up, Daniel, it'll be for many days, it's still future. Now, Daniel knew nothing of symbolic days. He didn't know that there's going to be a change in God's plan, that is, from fleshly Israel to spiritual Israel. And therefore, he was just sick at heart to think that the Lord's people would have to go through some more trouble. They've been going through all of these troubles, the nation of Israel, and now the Lord was indicating some more trouble in the future. Now, Daniel wasn't particularly interested in that ram, that is, that power of Medo-Persia. He wasn't interested in that he-goat which represented Greece. He wasn't so interested in that, but what he was interested in was his people, the nation of Israel. Now Daniel, in all the other visions where he pictured these various empires, he always showed them how they grew and how they prospered and so on. But it seemed that in each time God left out Israel. Where did Israel fit into this picture? Now, Daniel knew from Jeremiah's prophecy that these 70 years under Babylon were just about up. And so he thought perhaps they being up, the Lord would turn to Israel and begin blessing them. But now the Lord seemingly was heaping more trouble upon the nation. And now it seemed to Daniel that he was extending that period of 70 years by adding 2,300 days more of punishment. Daniel was really a bewildered and a troubled man. And then, as you would expect, Daniel lifts his heavy heart to the Lord in prayer. And his prayer is recorded in the 9th chapter, especially the 17th to the 19th verses. And there you'll notice that he's praying earnestly for the return of God's favor to Israel, for the promises that God made to the fathers of Israel. And while Daniel was yet praying over this vision of the 2300 days, which he misunderstood to mean the extension of the 70-year period, the Lord sent Gabriel again to correct this misunderstanding that Daniel had. And in chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, there you'll find Gabriel's further explanation. And in this explanation, Israel is featured. And that's what Daniel was looking for. He wanted to know just where Israel would fit into this picture. And for this, Daniel was glad. And so Gabriel begins, verse 24, and he says, Daniel, 70 weeks are going to be determined upon my people. A given time in your history will be set aside. 70 weeks. And we're going to start those 70 weeks, he says, from the beginning, that is, when the decree goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And Daniel, during these 70 weeks, great things are going to take place for your people. The city is going to be rebuilt, though under unfavorable conditions, but it'll be rebuilt. And lastly, very important, your Messiah is going to come. The one that you're looking for. But Daniel, this Messiah is going to be killed in the middle of that last week. You could imagine Daniel must have had mixed emotions. In some of this, he simply rejoiced in. The city of Jerusalem would be rebuilt. He was looking forward to that. The Messiah would come. That was wonderful. But why did Gabriel say that now the Messiah would come, but in the middle of that week, he was going to die? He just couldn't comprehend that. But this prophecy was not given for Daniel's benefit. This prophecy is given for to those who are living in this now period in God's plan. They would be able to comprehend its significance. Now let us consider chapter 8, beginning with verse 9. Now the prophecy speaks of a little horn. Now a horn in the scriptures represents a power. Now this horn became great and powerful. Now this little horn is represented by the legs and the feet of the image, Nebuchadnezzar's image. It's also represented by the beast in the vision. We're speaking about this horn. This horn represented the fourth universal empire of Rome. But as history continues, we see a transformation of the civil power of Rome into an ecclesiastical power of Rome. A change takes place. That civil power becomes papal Rome. Now it is this power that the prophecy indicates going to take away the daily sacrifice. It's going to take away the foundation of the church. Take it away completely. Now before we go any further, what is this daily sacrifice mentioned in the prophecy? This is the sacrifice of Christ. His sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. And it is this sacrifice of Christ that was set aside by this horn, set aside completely, and it introduced a new doctrine, which it called the Mass. The sacrifice of the Mass. And this erroneous doctrine claimed that Christ's death canceled Adam's original sin. But what it did not do was that it did not cover the daily sins and the weaknesses of the person. It was not a continual sacrifice, but it finished the work back there and it stopped. And for these personal sins, now we have to make a fresh sacrifice of Christ. And to accomplish this, Christ is to be created from bread and wine. And this bread and wine is then laid upon the altar. The priest comes and he utters these words of consecration. Hoc est autem corpus meum. And the minute he gets through, this bread and this wine turns into the actual flesh of Christ and his blood. Now, this is the ritual that has become an abomination in God's sight. Why? Because it takes away from Christ the sacrifice that he gave on behalf of the whole world. And it is this fundamental error which led to the full rejection of that system by the Lord. Because they rejected completely the ransom laid down by his Son. And in his sight, this became a desolating abomination. And so as a result of this defilement, this abomination, now the Lord has to perform a cleanup work. And through the prophet, we're informed that this cleanup work would take place completely at the end of 2300 days. Now we as students of God's Word have already proven, I'm sure, that the days mentioned in Daniel's prophecies are not literal days. They couldn't have possibly be literal days, but these are symbolic days. And the prophet Ezekiel, you remember, instructs us how to use the divine yardstick. He instructs us how to use this time measure that God has given us. When he tells us to use a day for a year. So then these prophetic days become years, prophetic years. And so we don't say 2300 days literally, but these now become 2300 years. Well, now where do we begin these 2300 years? Well, I think the clue is found in this 70-week period. And this also is a prophetic utterance. It is not 70 literal weeks, but it is symbolic, and it'll be 490 years. Literal years. Now, Daniel says that the 490 years are part of these 2300 years. The 2300 years and the 490 years, as we begin to study, we find begin at a given point. Both of these begin at a given point. 2300 years begin there as well as the 490 years. Now history tells us when the Lord died. It was in the spring of 33 A.D. Now the prophecy said that he would die in the middle of the 70th week. Now, some of the friends perhaps have difficulty in trying to understand this period, that is the last week of these 70 weeks. And so what we've done, we've taken this period of time, the 70th week, and we've made an enlargement of that on the blackboard. The figures in the semicircle represent years.
29 AD, 30 AD, and 36 all the way through. We take it each year and broken it up into its various seasons. Spring, summer, autumn, and winter, and likewise the leaves, and so on. Jesus came as the Messiah in the autumn of 29. And so we draw on. He died in the middle of the week in the spring of the year 33. We draw on. And then for 3.5 years, the Jew had favor until the fall of 36. And that will end this 70th week. So there you have the 3.5 years Jesus served here on earth. And then for 3.5 more years, favor was still extended to the Jew. And so there you have this period of time. 7 symbolic years. 7 literal years. Beginning with this 69th week. And here we have the figure of 483. 1810 will come to that very shortly.
But I trust that this will give you just a little better explanation of that period of time, the 70th week. Now, we provide a little problem up in the corner of the board.
If you take 2300 days and subtract 490 years, that means the years also, years, 490 years, or 2300 years, you have a figure of 1810. Then you add 36 years to bring you to the very beginning of counting our time, and we come up with the figure of 1846.
1846, the end of these symbolic 2300 days. 1846. This is the time when the sanctuary was to be cleansed of this defilement. Now, if this prophecy is correct, we're going to ask history to prove it. Now, historians are often unbelievers in the Bible. They don't believe in God. However, unknown to them, God is overruling in their work, so that whenever a prophecy has been fulfilled, the facts have been recorded correctly on the pages of history. And this has been so in the case of the cleansing of this sanctuary. This great cleanup work began with what the reformers, or that is historians, say, the Great Reformation period. And this, if you look in your history book, began in the 16th century. And you'll note that the keynote of this giant movement of the Reformation was justification by faith. Justification by faith in the continual sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That there was no need of repetition. What was this doing? This was in direct opposition to the Mass, which says that it is not a continual sacrifice. And this was the right place for the great movement to begin, because this formed the very foundation upon which the church would build, justification by faith. And soon, a champion arose to head this great movement, Martin Luther. And he became the leading spirit of this great movement. And he didn't stop by just uncovering this one truth of justification by faith, but he noticed that all of these things seemed to be connected. As you move one error, it shook 5 more. This whole network, full of errors. And so he began to overthrow one after another. And then in the year 1517, Luther marched to a church door in the city of Wittenberg, and there nailed upon the door 95 objections that he had to the papal system. 95 objections to the doctrines of papacy. Well, immediately the Pope naturally would be shaken, and he denounced this champion of Reformation. But Luther, in response, denounced completely the doctrines of the Mass, human immortality, and also the claim that the Pope made that he was God upon earth. But soon, this commendable work that began to lag by the wayside. These reformers began to sort of succumb to the flatteries that were put upon them by the leaders of the day, and they began to slow down. But this work had to go on. The Lord said at the end of these 2300 days, that sanctuary would be cleansed. And as we look along the pathway of the church from Luther's day up onward, we could recognize that step by step, there was a reformation work going on. But what we notice about each set of reformers is that just as soon as they finished their little job of cleaning a particular truth so it could shine, they stopped. They didn't go on to clean more, but they stopped. The Church of England began by casting aside some of the grosser doctrines of the Church of Rome, which claimed to be the only true church. But this daughter just left Mother Rome and began to lean on the government of England. But this was a step in the right direction. Here already was a partial cleansing. Then along came the reformers, Calvin and Knox. And they discovered that God's foreknowledge of transpiring events seemed to be limited by papacy. They realized that the success of God's plan did not depend on efforts from feeble man. But again, they only went so far and they stopped. And soon they were blinded into the error that all not elected to the heavenly state would go into eternal torture. And soon their doctrines, their teachings began to crystallize, and out of it came the sect of Presbyterianism. Then the Wesleys contributed their share in this cleansing work, and they stressed individual holiness through personal faith in Christ. They taught that because you were born under a so-called Christian government, and reckoned from birth as a member of that church-state system, that you were a Christian. And this was necessary. But, again, they only went so far, and they stopped. And the result was, another sect was formed, which put a fence around it, the Methodists. Then came the Baptists. And they did their little bit. They cast out another error, which papacy had in regards to baptism. They denied that the sprinkling of an infant is the baptism of Christ. And that was an important thing. But how far did they progress beyond that cleansing of that particular error? Next, to help this work, another sect came on the scene known as the Disciples. Here was something that others did not do. They advocated simplicity in church government. They believed that the Bible was the creed. Now this was in direct opposition to the elaborate system that the papal system set up, the cardinals, the priests, and the popes, and so on. They believed in equality for all members of Christ. And they also advocated the removal of all kinds of titles assigned to men. Cardinal, reverend, most reverend, and so on. And they began to emphasize the scripture that all ye are brethren, and one is your master, even Christ. In direct opposition to all that elaborate system that papacy stood for. This was a wonderful step in the right direction. But again, that's as far as they went. They didn't go far enough. Then came another reform, and by comparison, it seemed to be very thorough. There was a man connected with the Baptists, William Miller by name, who was the instrument to use, that was used by the Lord to start this particular reform. And Mr. Miller recognized something that all of these others apparently overlooked. And that is that there were time periods in God's plan. And that there was a second presence of Christ that was to take place soon. And that this second coming of Christ would result in a blessing for believers. He learned that the Lord was coming to set up a kingdom. And this, of course, would nullify the statement made by papacy when they said that they were the kingdom upon earth. And then another error which Mr. Miller helped to remove was the immortality of man. And this was done by calling attention to the Lord's second coming and the resurrection of the dead. Now, intelligent and thinking people began to wonder why the Lord would resurrect the dead if they were either in heaven or hell, and if their destiny was fixed. Why resurrect them again? Then they begin to wonder if man was immortal, why the dead were called dead. Then they wondered why the Lord and the apostles said nothing about the dead being still alive. But the Bible was very specific that the dead are dead. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. Then the Lord's words, all that are in the grave shall come forth, began to have a new meaning. It was then seen that the dead are not alive, but they are actually dead, because there was going to be a resurrection from the dead. How could they be alive? And soon that veil seemed to shroud this wonderful doctrine of ransom, just began to lift higher and higher. And all of a sudden, the beauty began to appear. The ransom of Jesus Christ. The meaning of it. They began to appreciate it. And as they began to see that, this network of defiling error began to be brushed aside. And the church was cleansed of this error. Now the value of this continual sacrifice of Jesus began to shine forth. And it had a reaction on other doctrines of the truth. And so in 1846, the end of these 2300 symbolic days, there was found unorganized a nucleus of Christians who agreed with the sect known as the Disciples in regards to simplicity in church government. They agreed that the Bible should be their creed. They believed that there should be no titles held by any human being. This little band of Christians also agreed with the Baptists, as far as the baptism was concerned. This little group of Christians also agreed with Luther in regard to the papal system as the man of sin, as the Antichrist. They believed that. And this little class of Christians soon began to, it was necessary for them to stand aloof from the world. And they began to teach piety and simple trust in God. And they began to guard the truths that were purchased. And they began to see the value of this ransom. And then, in this year, 1846, it seems that God would stamp this year with his personal stamp. Because in that year, as you look into your history books, the Evangelical Alliance was formed. And this was an organization of all the Protestant sects. And the first meeting took place on September 2nd, 1846. 921 members attended that meeting, 47 from Europe, 87 from America, and others elsewhere. 50 denominations attended that meeting. This organization was mindful of the new views of the cleansed sanctuary. And they set up a creed. And they clearly defined its faith, their faith in human immortality. Oh, they weren't going to let go of that error. They're going to hold on to that. And they made that one of their articles in their creed. Then also the Trinity. Oh, they couldn't leave go of that. And that was accepted also as one of the articles in their creed. They had to retain these errors. Something that the cleansed sanctuary did not believe and could not accept. And so, in 1846, there you have a clear division. Cleansed sanctuary, this little tiny group of Christians on this side, and the vast majority of churchianity on the other. And to this class, faithful children of God have been added since. But to maintain their standing against this organized opposition in great numbers becomes a severe test. And the test still remains with us today. It takes courage. It takes faith to stand up in front of all of these churches that exist today. But then there was still another blessing. A special blessing that will be experienced by the cleansed sanctuary. And Daniel tells about that in 12:12, when he said, "Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh through the 1335 days." The Lord was going to come the second time. And this seemed to be the crowning feature, as it were. And since 1874, I'm sure you realize, the beauty and the grandeur of the divine plan just began to unfold and shine forth. And then the Lord appointed a special messenger, a servant, to dispense meat in due season. And that was done. That's why you and I are here today, because of that. And then this message of the kingdom, as the sanctuary class accepted it, represented symbolically in the book of Revelation, chapter 10. And there you remember John was speaking of a little book, and he actually ate this book, literally, not literally, but in a symbolic sense. And he says, as he ate this little book, it was sweet as honey, but when it reached his inward parts, what happened? Oh, it wasn't so sweet. No, he said that his belly became bitter. And I think this is an experience that every consecrated child of God has. Oh, when he accepts the truth, oh, how wonderful, how sweet it is. But when he accepts that truth, then the experiences come. Then you have a blending of bitterness and sweetness. It costs something. Yes, throughout the world, there we have these little bands of people. A little band in Minneapolis, a little band in Phoenix, a little band in California, all little bands, but if you put them all together, it's still a little band. Separate, yes, distinct, yes, completely from any organization, recognized by no one of the world. No religious organization ever recognizes us. But let us remember that the Lord esteems these little bands here and there as his people because they have his truth. And so you and I are actually standing on a figurative Mount Pisgah. We can see high up just as Moses saw that land. We have a great vantage point and we can look completely around and we can see the whole picture. This is a view that only you and I have. Christianity can't see their way down in the below here someplace. and they can see very little. But you and I are way up on that mountaintop, and we can turn around and we have a complete picture, a complete picture of the glorious kingdom that God is bringing in. We can see the great work of this millennial day, and we can see how we fit into this grand work of restitution. And so, brethren, may this grand view that you and I see from this Mount Pisgah be an inspiration to us. May it energize us to even a greater service in this kingdom work. May the Lord add his blessing.
Part of the service by the use of hymn 32. Hymn 32.